We're going to get started with the next session. Integrating image, radar, IR, and TOF sensors, developing vision systems with dissimilar sensors. Our speaker is Tom Watzke. Tom is the technical mobile solutions architect at Lattice Semiconductor. He serves as the marketing product manager at the CrossLink Video Bridge product line, focused on mobile and mobile-influenced markets. He has more than 20 years of experience developing embedded products, including 7 years developing consumer mobile solutions. Please welcome Tom Watzke.
Thank you. So hello, I'm Tom Watzke, and as he said, I'm a product marketing manager with Lattice Semiconductor. We make FPGAs, so my talk will be circulating a little bit around FPGAs. But the product CrossLink that I was talking about, or that I was introduced as, was originally designed to be a simple MIPI video bridge. And it served its purpose. So initially, we were doing simple bridging like RGB to CSI or that sort of thing. As our applications proceeded, we started getting more involved in aggregation of CSI signals. So two cameras aggregated into maybe a single CSI stream. And so as things went on, we started getting involved in more dissimilar sensors. And so that's why I'm here now. I want to provide some of our experience in working in that area. So my predecessor, HB, was talking about the larger picture of working with SoCs in relation to the MIPI environment. I'm going to be focused a little bit down further in how you manage the camera video streams to get them into that SoC processor. So first I want to talk about sensors themselves. So Semico is a research company. They did some research on where sensors are going for the next several years. And they picked three sub-markets. One of them is automotive and drones, and then there's the AR and VR headsets. These are high-volume markets, and in all of them, they see dramatic growth in the sensors themselves, primarily because there's going to be more sensors per product. So I'll talk about each one of those in the following slides. So the automotive environment. So HB also gave you a couple of automotive pictures. This is a similar one. But what I want to get across here is there's a proliferating number of sensors and types of sensors. There's imaging sensors. If you recall, several years ago, the only sensor you had in your car was the rear view for parking. And now they got sensors for object detection, pedestrian detection, that sort of thing. They have LiDAR for emergency braking. And then they have a variety of short, medium, and long-range radar as well. The problem that presents is you got to get this data to the application processor. And the problem with the application processor, it has a limited number of IOs to absorb all this data. So you need some sort of device in between to get that data into the processor. For the drone environment, it's a similar problem. Different sensors in some aspects, but a similar problem. You got a variety of image cameras. Then you may have some ultrasonic sensors, as well as different time of flight sensors like LiDAR, for example, light detection and ranging. And then maybe even IR. But the same problem. You got a bunch of sensors that have maybe different resolutions, different characteristics. You got to get them into that pin-constrained application processor. AR and VR is very similar. Now, back in the day when the first VR headsets came out, they did their head positioning by accelerometers, gyrometers, magnetometer-type sensors. And that allowed them, with a little sensor fusion, to It allows you to get the relative head position so that you can move your image along with your body movements. The problem with that is these sensors tend to accumulate tolerance errors over time. So as I'm using this device and walking around, over a period of time, my home position might be off by a half a degree or so. For the VR environment, no big deal, because you don't care where you're actually pointing as long as you can get to that part of your vision. Now, for AR, the problem is a little bit different. So I can be wearing an AR headset right now, which will have a semi-transparent display. So I'll see you all out there in the audience, but I might be running an AR application at the same time. And I might have, for example, my friendly monster sitting in this empty seat over here. So if I had, while I'm talking to you, if I had a traditional headset on, that those tolerances will add up and that monster might start gradually lifting off the chair. Okay? We don't want that. So what we've been doing, or what the industry's been doing, is moving away from those sorts of sensors and moving towards environment awareness cameras. Now, those cameras actually look out at the environment and find mathematically significant points out there. Now, it could be wrinkles in the curtains, details in the carpet, corners on the tables, that sort of thing. There's typically hundreds or thousands of them. The advantage of that approach is now my augmented reality is referenced to reality, rather than being referenced to sensors in my head mount display. So the end result is I got a lot more sensors, more imaging type of sensors in my headset. And so that is what's proliferating the number of sensors in the AR, VR, MR realm. But at the end of the day, it's the same problem. I got a lot of sensors, I got to get into that constrained application processor. So that is the main volume of applications. Automotive, drones, headsets, that sort of thing. But there's a lot of applications in the broad market. And I'll just give you one example. An inspection station in an industrial environment for inspecting PC boards. So it may have multiple cameras on it. One camera is focused on getting the image and monitoring the image of the whole PC board, and there may be one or more cameras that are focused on different region of interest. And it's a slightly different problem here in that camera subsystem can be sending out multiple video streams, or it can send those multiple video streams through a set of virtual channels in one stream. And I'm going to talk about virtual channels in a little bit. So how do you combine multiple streams? So when we started out, we were addressing two or more identical cameras. And we were able to synchronize those cameras so that the video streams were synchronized. And then it was just a simple matter for us just to concatenate those signals. And so the output image that we transported to the application processor was simply an image that was twice the aspect ratio of the input. So that's with identical sensors. So what do you do then with dissimilar sensors, where maybe you have different frame rates, different resolutions, different bandwidths? So in this case, I'm showing an image of a statue. The top image is maybe a higher resolution visual image in the visual spectrum. And the bottom one is maybe an IR heat map, okay, that may be lower resolution, but gets the IR information. So you got data coming in at different frequencies and in different block lengths. What you do then is you have to assemble these video streams as they come in, and you concatenate them afterwards. But and then send them out as a virtual video stream. So what you have to do is, with each one of those packets, you have to tag it with the camera or the video source number. So that's sort of the problem statement. Now, the solution comes from MIPI. So MIPI CSI is a packetized format. So there's a header, there's your payload data, and there's a footer. So in the header, there is a variety of fields. Okay, the fields could include a data length, data type, and it also includes a field called virtual channels, just to solve this problem I was talking about. So in particular, initially in version 1.2 and 1.3 of CSI, MIPI assigned 2 bits for virtual channeling, which gave us a potential of funneling 4 video streams into 1 video stream. And then in a later version of CSI 2, MIPI provided 2 more bits of information in version 2.0 to give us a total of 16 virtual channels in a single stream. Now, I'm referring to a CSI application that's running over DeFi. In the case of running over CFI, there's a little bit more flexibility in that PHY, and they have even more virtual channel capability, but I'm not going to talk about that here. Okay, so I gave you the problem statement, and I gave you the solution. So MIPI, bless their hearts, gave us the solution. Now we have a way of getting data into pin-constrained application processors. So what I'm here today to discuss with you are the issues that you'll have in implementing those solutions. The first issue is fairly simple. And HB, for example, spoke about this roundaboutly in mapping video sources to an output with VC. Now, if you have 4 or less channels coming in, then it's an easy solution to just map that data to your output video stream, and you're done. But in the lower block diagram, in the case where you have more than 4 virtual channels, you have 2 issues to deal with. If your application processor can support CSI 2 version 2, then you're good. That can, because it can support up to 16. But in the case that it can't, you have a couple of options. If you recall very early, a little bit ago, I said one way to combine video streams is to concatenate identical cameras, right? So if there are a couple identical cameras in your collection, then you can concatenate a couple of them and treat them as one of the VCs. Another possible way if you recall, I mentioned that your header data contains a field called data type. So data type is traditionally intended to identify the type of data that's in the packet. More specifically, what kind of color space it's in, RGB or YUV, that sort of thing. But there's nothing that says you can't use it to extend your virtual channel field. So that's a simple problem. Clocking. CSI is a packetized format. You transmit a packet in high-speed mode. At the end of that packet, your channel transitions from high-speed to low-power mode. When the next packet is ready to transmit, you transition from low-power mode back to high-speed mode. So your PHY has the option of keeping the MIPI DeFi clock running during that low-power state. So if your data source camera continues to run the clock in that state, you have a fairly simple architectural problem in that you can run everything off of that input clock. Everything is synchronized off of that. But in low-power applications, specifically battery-powered applications, you want to turn the clock off during that low-power state. Most cameras that are on the market today have the option to be configured in that mode, non-continuous clock mode. The problem that presents to you, the designer, is now your clock goes away during these low power states, and you need to keep your logic running. So you got to add another reference clock. Now, architecturally, that doesn't look like a big problem. The only problem it presents is that, as the digital designer, you're now confronted with multiple clock domains inside of your chip. So let's talk about clock domains. So in the simple case on the left, this is one of the simple applications that I described to you earlier. This is where you have two identical cameras running identical clock speeds that are coming into your system, and you need to aggregate them. So each one of those receivers needs to be running in its own clock domain. Now, why? It's running the same frequency. Why do you need its own domain? Because you're going to have phasing differences between the two. So you really need to keep, while you're working in the bit domain on those left transceivers, you need to be running different domains. Now, once you translate those bit domains into word domains, you move it across yet another block domain into your output transmitter. The problem with this diagram is moving data between these clock domains. If you don't treat it appropriately, you can lose data or corrupt data. One of the cleanest ways to move data across clock domains is with a dual port RAM that's configured as a FIFO. Those are by design, they'll get the data across for you. Somebody else has worried about that problem. For you, the designer, what you have to worry about is those ancillary signals, those control signals that are going across that domain as well. Now, in the right example that I have, this is a case where you have two dissimilar signals or two dissimilar clock image sources that you have to work with. It's very similar. They have to have their own domains with the bit domain data coming in. They got to go across the clock domain to work with the word data. Now, the word data in this case is running at a different frequency. So now you're still in a different clock domain. So then you translate this word data into your transmitter domain and transmit your data out. So you'll notice in that right block diagram, there's four transitions. Just for two cameras, you got four transitions between five different clock domains. So again, FIFOs handle all that. A good quality FIFO will handle all that. You got to worry about all those other signals. And the key thing that you probably heard about is metastability. You have to deal with metastability. So I'm trying to keep this reasonably short. What I've given you is the problem statement, the solution from MIPI, bless their hearts, and the issues that you have to watch out for in design. Now, that's the problem today. What I've described to you today is, at the real high level, is we have a bunch of data sources. We're going to funnel them down into a couple high-speed pipes and get it to the application processor. And that, by and large, has worked. The system architects are starting to come back to the designers now and say, wait a minute. You're pumping all this data to us. Some of it we don't even want or need. And we got to deal with it. Let's start balancing the load. So this is an example block diagram that sort of summarizes a lot of the pain points that we see in the field. So just focus for a moment. Just focus on the two blocks in the lower center, the ROI and the downscaling. So the processor is interested. The application is interested in a number of things. Obviously, data. It doesn't, or video data. It doesn't necessarily need high resolution data. In a lot of cases, it needs that high resolution data. But in some cases, it's just interested in focusing on one region. And in that case, you can use the CCI, so coming from the application processor, the camera control interface, to feed back to a balanced piece of hardware that can identify what kind of data it wants to receive, region of interest data or maybe downscale data. So why is downscaling data of value? You know, why do you want to eliminate resolution and have it sent to you as the application processor? The reason is a lot of machine learning algorithms are very compute intensive. And as you increase the resolution, your computation goes up geometrically. So you want to limit the amount of data that you're applying your neural networks to, but not too much that you lose the data that you need. And typically, right now, we're seeing a lot of machine learning algorithms work perfectly well at VGA levels. Okay, so back to the block diagram. Our data sources may be virtual channels coming in, may not be, maybe regular cameras coming in. But if they are virtual channels, we want to unvirtualize them and get them down to the raw data streams. Send them through a multiplexer and to decide which ones maybe get filtered by region of interest, which ones get filtered by downscaling. And then sending them through yet another multiplexer, virtualize them, and send them off to the processor. So that's what we see going forward. So when I first came out here, I introduced myself as a fella coming from an FPGA company. So how do we look at life? Well, we look at solutions as FPGA solutions. And so I want to describe to you the flow of the design flow and the differences between ASICs and FPGAs and why you really want to consider FPGAs. So if you look on the right, the flow chart there, the first three steps are identical for ASICs or FPGAs. It's design, simulate, and synthesize. And there's feedback loops between all of those blocks. But once you're done with an FPGA, you go into hardware debug at that point. With an ASIC, there's this whole back-end flow. There's your masks, there's fabrication, testing, qual, and then you go into production. Each one of those blocks have a large dollar sign and a large schedule impact. So, again, why FPGAs? Faster time to market. We get you debugging very quick. Lower NRE. Those two enable innovation. So a lot of questions we're asked is, FPGAs are more expensive. In a lot of video applications, you have a lot of IOs to deal with. And those IOs define the minimum silicon size that you can use. And very often, that's the size of that silicon is less than the logic that you need inside. So at the end of the day, FPGAs, ASICs, they're the same cost. Size equals cost. And power, the power in these video applications is largely a function of the transceivers themselves and not as much with the logic inside. And so there's not a lot of reason. We talk to a lot of high-volume companies and low-volume companies. Not many of them are going to ASICs anymore because of the all of the reasons that I just went through. So that's really my talk. So everything that I referred to, I really referred to two documents from MIPI. I have the links there. And I can take questions if you'd like. I have a couple minutes.
So, Hill, can you bring the mic down here?
So ASIC is more optimized about certain applications, so it will be more useful for high-speed application. Maybe in your application, FPGA and ASIC is not different, but in general, ASIC has more value in certain area.
Okay, so if I can repeat it to make sure I understood it. ASICs, FPGAs are limited because they have a flexible fabric, and so therefore you can get a higher performance out of an ASIC. Okay, is that could be true. Now, in some cases, in the one FPGA that I manage, for example, has hardened DeFis. And those hardened DeFis have gearing up front that gears down the data before it goes into our slower fabric. So we run our DeFis, our present product, for example, runs at 1.5 gigs per lane with no problem. Yes, that can be true. We do have, in some cases, you can get limitations inside the fabric, but we don't really see that as an issue.
Yeah, you mentioned that the synthesis is the same, but FPGA and ASIC is different, I assume. And it's consume more time of synthesis, no? Because you need to, timing is not the correct, or no?
Yes, so I have a, if I can go, can I go back here? Let's go. Go on. This isn't letting me go backwards.
No, once they,
So, the only thing I was going to show you is I tried to simplify the flowchart. In my flowchart, I had design, simulate, synthesis. They're all the same, then you split off. Well, the synthesis is very different for FPGAs than they are for ASICs. And the reason is with FPGAs, if you make a mistake and discover that bug in your debug cycle, it just means that you got to loop back and resynthesize. Okay, so the synthesis block in ASICs is a lot bigger effort, because if you make a mistake and find it down the road, it's a big cost impact. So they are different. I agree.
Any other questions?
So, can you consider FPGA for mobile applications with low power technology? I mean, low power applications, can we consider FPGA for that?
Of course.
So up to what limit?
Are you asking about what power limits or what speed limits?
Power limits now. Currently, there are so many applications that just go for ASICs because of the power limitation and area. So most of the mobile applications and maybe automobile, not big issue, but I think mobile phones or other applications similar, they require very low power consumption. And I think
yes.
FPGA cannot provide that limit in my thinking.
Now I'm going to go into Lattice specific. Lattice devices are the product that I'm working with was originally designed for mobile products, specifically DSLR cameras and cell phones. So it's designed for low power. Now, MIPI itself consumes power. There's nothing you can do about that. You've got a high speed video stream. But typically, our devices will consume, when they're running at, say, 1.5 gigs per lane, and say all four lanes are running, typically we're well below 100 milliwatts.
Any other questions? You were talking about dissimilar sensors. What happens if you have a sensor in your network that does not support CSI?
So the question is, this whole time I was telling you about all of these sensors. They could be vision-based cameras. They could be radar, sonar, that sort of thing. And I was making the assumption that they're all sending data out in CSI video streams. Well, if they're not, at the end of the day, we're talking about getting data into the application processor, and that data has to be in CSI format. So the short answer is you just bridge from, let's say, if it's RGB, you just do a simple bridge to CSI, and you're off and running. You get it through the down the CSI stream.
All right, Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you.